There are many things that we have had to learn to live without here in 2020, but there is one annual tradition that will not be stopped by the corona. It's the annual World Almanac and Book of Facts. The new edition for 2021 has just been released, and it's over 1,000 pages of things you need to know, want to know, and had no idea you wanted to know, but are glad you do now. Sarah Jansen is the editor of the World Almanac and Book of Facts for 2021. We spoke about the history of the World Almanac.
So the World Almanac has actually been around since 1868. And if you're doing the math, that's a little over 150 years that we've been publishing. Obviously, I was not there at the very beginning. It started as a supplement to the New York World newspaper, which was one of Joseph Pulitzer's newspapers in New York City all way back when. And it was sort of developed to be a supplement and a what they called a universal compendium of facts. And while we don't really use that language for it anymore, we do still try to be as universal as possible in our coverage. So trying to cover everything from the news of the year to pop culture to sports, to science and technology, and everything in between.
Over the years, has reader feedback shaped what you put in the book or what you might take out?
Oh, absolutely. We do hear from readers, and we do enjoy hearing from them. You know, sometimes the ideas are better than others, but we do always enjoy seeing the feedback that we get, especially from people who have been, you know, reading the book maybe even longer than a lot of our staff has. I think, you know, there are certain fans of World Almanac or annual buyers of World Almanac that have been getting this book and remember it from many decades ago. And certainly we are always trying to make a book that comes out annually that serves all of our readers, from those who are longtime fans to those who are just hearing about us and giving us a shot for the first time.
Do you get feedback from schools on this?
Oh, definitely, yes. Teachers, librarians definitely give us lots of feedback, lots of information about not just what they like the World Almanac for, but what they would like to see. You know, I think a lot of educators are now paying a lot of attention to things like media literacy and, you know, how to develop students who are not just good learners and researchers, but who can really, you know, think critically about the information that they're coming across while doing research. And that's something that the World Almanac has always taken very seriously, just, you know, as a reference publication, but also from many years ago, we've been publishing with, you know, our statistical data, our list of sources. Just about every table in this book, you'll find the source of the data right there with the title, and you'll be able to go and do your own further research. A lot of the times what we can fit into print isn't all of the universe of that data, so you can actually find out even more if you're interested in a particular table or subject.
I particularly like the color section with all the flags. That just looks great.
I love the maps of the world and the flags as well. And, you know, it's always been sort of interesting to me. You don't think that those are things that change that much, but they really do. You know, you do see nations develop their new flags or change their preferred name styling or wording, and borders can change. You know, these are things that the World Almanac always has to keep an eye on, because it's maybe not going to be on the front page or hitting a news alert on your phone, but these are things that reflect the changing world and the way that we position ourselves and others in it. And certainly the World Almanac needs to reflect all of those things.
So what is new for the 2021 edition? I see we've already got a whole lot of coronavirus information in there.
That's true. I mean, 2020, I think, will be remembered for that, among other things, but very much for that being the dominant news story. And not just, you know, a news story as far as headlines go, but one that really impacted so many different parts of our lives. So we do have a special feature section on the coronavirus pandemic from a scientific angle, along with some data and some really great graphics. But we also have the World Almanac covers so many different topics that the coronavirus, because it also percolated in so many different areas of our lives, you know, it gets covered elsewhere in the book as well, not just in that special feature. So, for example, you know, in our sports chapters, those all had some pretty transformed coverage in 2020. We also have new statistics showing the changes to airplane travel. The number of people that are actually going through airports is just, the graph on that is really spectacular. And of course, economics and unemployment, these are all things that are reflecting everything that's going on in the world via their data in ways that we don't always see with our number one news stories every year.
When is this book locked? Because I see you already have 2020 election results in there.
Yes. So the World Almanac actually publishes so many copies that we print certain sections of the book that are less time sensitive beginning in October. But the election results, of course, we had to wait for. And those parts of the book did not print until mid-November. Then it all gets put together in one cohesive form so that we can get it out and into stores in time for the holidays and time for people to, you know, observe their annual traditions with it.
Is there anything of note that has been taken out of the book or been corrected in the past year or so?
We try not to take too much out, by which I mean even where we have to find room for a lot of new information, we do try to, instead of getting something cut altogether, we might shorten it. Or, you know, maybe the events in the history section in the 90s, we can slim that down a little bit to make room for the events in the aughts and 2010s, that kind of thing. It's definitely a balancing act because the book is the same length every year. But, you know, sometimes you'll get an assist from other developments. So, for example, we had to cover a lot of the coronavirus elements in 2020 and certainly needed to make room for that. But because we had planned on having some pages to cover the Olympic Games in Tokyo, and those were postponed, we were able to shift some pages over. And so it's kind of a balancing act in that respect.
And other than just facts and figures, are there any other kinds of features in the book people might be interested in?
We have, well, speaking of the Olympics, they actually have a really great feature on past Olympics, memorable moments from past Summer Olympic Games. You know, I think the Olympics is something that the Almanac editors really enjoy covering every year, and it was a little bit disappointing to see that they were postponed to 2021, but it did give us the opportunity to talk a little bit about, you know, memorable moments from the 28 prior Summer Olympic Games as we look ahead to Tokyo. So that was a lot of fun.
In the age when almost everybody has access to information in their pocket, how do you keep this book relevant in the digital age?
You know, I think that the World Almanac has been relevant and is still relevant because it's the kind of book where you can open it and flip to a random page. And if you're curious about the world, you're going to find something to be fascinated by. And it might be something that you would have never thought to Google for yourself, that might never get served to you via algorithm, but that you, because you're interested in the world, you're interested in this fact or this set of statistics, or maybe just reading, you know, an article about one of the 195 countries in the world that we have articles on, or one of the 50 states in the union. These are things that you might not necessarily seek to find for yourself, but it's sort of fun and almost serendipitous to sort of go through a book like the World Almanac that way.
So when do you start on the next one?
Oh, we're already working on it. We're already looking ahead to World Almanac 2022 and sort of looking forward to seeing what we can do. Of course, we'll have to sort of see what happens in the next few months and weeks and see how much more the book will transform going forward.
Sarah Jansen is the editor of the World Almanac and Book of Facts for 2021. By the way, when we started our conversation, I tried to make a little joke. You know, taking a look at the book, it's like having Google in your hand, isn't it?
It sure is. We should put you on our marketing staff. That should be our tagline.
Good. Negotiations are pending. Still to come, how does a student apply for college while everything in the world is changing, and not in a good way? That conversation's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. have any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In the best of times, a student starting the search for a college can be a stressful experience. Doing this in the middle of a global pandemic certainly doesn't help. Across the country, there are professional college counselors who can help point a student and their family in the right direction. So to get a bit of an idea of what these counselors are telling students, why not call one up and ask? That's how I met Noor Haddad. She is a college counselor with CollegeWise, a college counseling, tutoring, and test prep company in Southern California. We started out by talking about the challenges of finding financial aid in the age of COVID-19 and ended up talking about the whole college application experience.
You know, a lot of students this year are having a lot of difficulty based on things like the economic downturn, some of their parents losing their jobs. There are lots of factors that go into students trying to apply for financial aid. And one of the biggest pieces that goes into this is the requirements for scholarships in some cases. So just to give you a little bit of a background, historically in the world of admissions, there are some requirements that students have to follow in order to qualify for financial aid. And so that typically, to kind of break it down a little bit, students will usually apply for federal financial aid applications, which is called the FAFSA. We're seeing a lot of a decrease in those applications. There are many students who are worried about their ability to be able to pay for college in the first place. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of drops in those applications, sadly. Another piece of this is there are some colleges in this country, even though they have responded to this pandemic with the ability for students to forego standardized testing for admission, some universities are still requiring that a student take the SAT or ACT in order to qualify for scholarship money. So there are some barriers that are standing in those students' ways. And, you know, we really want to be able to see the same numbers that we do for students applying to college and being able to qualify for financial aid. But there are so many issues that we're seeing, standardized testing being one of them, family situations changing being another, some students taking on full-time jobs and foregoing their plans for college right after their high school senior year. There are many, many barriers that are standing in the way, and sadly, students having the same numbers of applications to college and applications for financial aid is one of them.
How is having to take one of the standardized tests a barrier? Are there just no places to take it right now?
There are lots of reasons behind that. So in my state of California, the majority of test centers have been canceled for both the ACT and SAT since March. So in response to this pandemic, when everything kind of first started in the middle of March, the SAT was canceled nationwide. And in response to the future test dates, the institutions that run the ACT and SAT had then put the onus on to testing centers, which are typically high schools, in some cases other sites, but are hosted by school-based people, to cancel the exams. So widely, when schools have been closed, the test centers haven't been open at the same time. So that's one of the pieces. The other piece is there are many, many students who are afraid for their immunocompromised family and not wanting to go and be in a room of 40 students to gather. That's been a really preventative factor here. And I, as a counselor, really want to make sure to focus on the safety and health of my students. But if a student is looking to apply to a college that still hasn't eliminated their requirement for standardized testing, they have to go and find a place to go test in that situation. But the issue is largely that test centers are not able to host the test in a wide variety as they would normally.
And with so many colleges and universities going test-free, how can, let's call it, an average student make themselves more attractive and stand out to these institutions?
That's a great question. And I will kind of respond to the question, average student. I call me an optimist. I always find, you know, that every student has something about them, right, that makes them stand out, that makes them them. So in focusing on that, you're eliminating a huge stressor out of this application. You're eliminating something that has caused so much anxiety for students, something that has stood as a barrier of admission. So let's say a student for 4 years has done really well in school, but they have very severe test anxiety. That test score was that thing standing in the way of them, and now it's gone. So now they are free to focus on their curiosity in class, some of the hobbies that they can do at home, even though we aren't able to do sports in the same way. We aren't able to do some of the group activities that students would typically do in a normal school year the same way. I've had so many students tell me that they've picked up a painting hobby, that they have started reading more, that they've been trying to engage with their classmates on Zoom, online, and try to make a good environment for people while we're in this very unusual time. So, you know, focusing on themselves, focusing on the things that they are able to do to show themselves. Many students also have really been picking up on family responsibilities and supporting their family members. So all of these things kind of go into what makes you stand out as a student, aside from just having this test score that in some ways defines students more than they wanted it to.
Is remote learning and the lack of in-person interaction with teachers and administrative staff, is this also an issue?
A lot of my students have been asking this. So the thing is, yes, students across the country are not able to be with their teachers, with their classmates in person. There are some students who have opted to go fully remote or go to a hybrid model of learning. And although the environment is different, there are still ways for a student to make connections with their teachers and to support their classmates. Many, many students are in a situation where they either have their full class schedule online, they're meeting with their teachers in the same way, or they have an abridged version of this. Teachers will often hold office hours for those students to still be able to chat. They'll still have kind of Zoom time in the morning where they get to talk with their classmates and talk with their teachers. Although we don't get to have, you know, a traditional hand raise in person in a traditional classroom, there are still ways for students to support their teacher, to ask questions, to still be curious in the virtual classroom. So it's really more about adapting rather than not having as many opportunities to make those connections.
So what can students do? What are some tips for making this process an easier thing in this year?
What's been really amazing about this is that so many resources have become available to students in response to what has been happening and students being home, colleges not being able to visit them. I've seen such an uptick in college visits that are virtual, student-run panels that are allowing students to have a glimpse into college student life that they wouldn't have normally. There are so many opportunities that students are having. It's just that they have to find those places to seek them out. They have to find the resources that they need in order to do that. So what I always recommend to students, no matter where they are in this process, maybe they're just getting started, they still have time to apply. I would recommend they carve out some time, maybe a couple hours on Saturday or Sunday, to just sit down and think, what is my ideal situation? What kind of environment am I looking for? How can I look for a college that will support me for the next 4 years? What are the qualities I'm looking for in them? From there are many resources that they can use to kind of help plan this out. And I'm old school. I always recommend that students write things down. I know that there are so many resources on the phone and on the internet for them to kind of keep track of things, but sometimes it really helps to have an actual physical planner or a notebook to just get all their thoughts out on paper and start from there. You know, and from there, there's plenty of resources surrounding college research. And, you know, I think depending on where the student is starting, they're starting in senior year, they obviously have a little bit of a shorter time to plan for college. But if they're starting at junior year right now, they can start with resources surrounding thinking about what majors they're interested in. And if they're not sure yet, talking about an undecided major, talking about what kinds of qualities they want in a college. Do they want to attend college that actually has four seasons of weather? Do they want to attend a college that has a traditional football program? Do they want to attend a college that has a version of a science Olympiad because they enjoyed it so much in high school? So writing all these qualities down is helpful for the student to kind of take agency and take charge in this process. And I always recommend that they carve out a little bit of college time on the weekends, depending on what other responsibilities. That just allows them to really focus on what they're looking for.
And is financial aid just as available as it was before?
That's a good question, too. So there's not necessarily anything indicating that it's not as available as before. What's important for students to focus on is that they're following priority deadlines to apply for financial aid. So often colleges will say to students, please submit this federal financial aid form by this date to ensure priority scholarship consideration. So we want students to kind of make sure that they're following those deadlines. They're filling out the applications that they need. In some cases, in addition to the FAFSA, which I was referring to, an institution will have their own financial aid application. In some cases for private and some public universities, there's also a financial aid form called the CSS profile that students have to fill out. But we ensure students to kind of make sure to do their research to keep track of when those deadlines are so they can have full scholarship consideration. Now, there are other factors in play here when it comes to things like Pell Grants, which are the federal grants distributed by the government. And, you know, when we talk about things like funding those Pell Grants, those are always kind of in budgets that are in discussion. So, you know, aside from kind of knowing what's available at the institutional level, we also have to think about the federal level of aid that is available to students. So as we're seeing this level of the economy at this moment, there are going to be some colleges that have to make budget cuts. And so in response to that, although without knowing at this point what scholarship aid looks like, we just want to ensure that those students are following those financial aid deadlines that they have to adhere to in order to achieve the maximum amount of aid that they could possibly can get.
So we've got a student just about ready to start this. Where can they go for a little help?
So I have a lot of ideas for resources. I do want to start with a resource that we are actually offering through CollegeWise. It is a free resource called CollegeWise Runway. And so I actually had the privilege to be able to be a part of this project and build it from the ground up. It's filled with resources on how to identify what majors you might be interested in, build your college list, write your application essays, keep track of all your deadlines. There are tons of resources for students and for counselors as well. So a student can go to our website, look for CollegeWise Runway, and be able to sign up for free and have all of these resources available to them. In addition to that, there are lots of places that students can look for some guidance. So the Common Application, which is an application that many, many colleges, hundreds of them, use for their kind of hosting of the application. They have a lot of great resources for students as well. There's another resource from College Board called Big Future that has a really comprehensive college search. That's another great resource for students. So many, many places that they can go to. But I think if they're starting from scratch and they want some guidance from our expert counselors, I would really recommend checking out Runway. And that will be kind of a great place for them to start brainstorming and thinking about what they would like to do with their future.
Noor Haddad is a college counselor with CollegeWise. Everything you need to become the next big documentary filmmaker could be resting comfortably in your pocket right now. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Handheld videos are the norm in today's society. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, David Ruscha, associate professor of film studies, explores the beginnings of this type of filmmaking.
For decades, documentary filmmakers were anchored to large, heavy cameras and sound equipment. They often had to organize the world around the camera, staging events and relying on voiceover narration to tell the audience about the world instead of showing it. The world of documentary filmmaking changed dramatically in the early 1960s, in large part because of the contributions of documentarian Robert Drew. Drew and his associates developed lighter, more mobile cameras, together with a new philosophy about filmmaking. Instead of lecturing audiences about the world and using images to illustrate these words, they use their handheld cameras and wireless sound equipment to observe and explore the world. They wanted to give viewers a sense of being there, witnessing for themselves what was happening in their communities and across the globe. Audiences were finally able to see and hear what was once staged and fabricated. These profoundly innovative films included The Chair, an intense minute-by-minute account of two lawyers fighting to save a man from the electric chair, and Crisis, an intimate portrait of John F. Kennedy's struggle against Governor George Wallace to ensure the enrollment of two black students at the University of Alabama. Sometimes called direct cinema or cinema verite, the influence of this observational approach to filmmaking is apparent in almost all corners of visual media today. Evident in the frenetic handheld camera work of Hollywood films like The Bourne Identity and video games like Call of Duty, to the immersive reporting of Vice News, and even the candid nature of social networking services like TikTok, Robert Drew's films from nearly 60 years ago opened up new aesthetic and storytelling possibilities for generations of film and media makers.
That was David Russia of Oxford College at Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.